Hello, everybody. It is 7 p.m. It's Wednesday night, and that means it's time for Mass Office Hours Live. My name's Eric Trexler. I am your regular host every single week in the trenches with you, solving fitness-related problems. Today, we are joined by the good Dr. Eric Helms, one of my esteemed colleagues from the Mass Research Review. Helms, how are we doing tonight?
Better now that I get to see your lovely face, my friend.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. What is new in Helms world? What have you been up to lately?
Jeez, what's new? Well, I've kind of got things solidified for June, which I'm really looking forward to. I'm going to be getting the opportunity to judge not only at WNBF Spain, but also WNBF Italy, before then finally doing the next weekend, so three successive weekends from mid-June to the end, a presentation for British powerlifting. So getting the opportunity to kind of give back to the two sports, which I love. And yeah, also got seminar on those two competition days. So just kind of sorting my whole 3-week trip in Europe for the most part.
Very cool. And I've been wondering, where do you find the gall to judge another person's body?
Well, it's generally the whole premise of the entire sport that you and I are both multi-types of professionals in. I think we're professional body judgers, actually. So, or I guess you're just a judgee.
Yeah.
Have you judged?
No, I've not judged. It's an ethical stance
would,
I've taken.
You would
but
do
I'm,
that.
I'm right. Interested to see that you don't have a similar ethical compass. And I think it's interesting for the viewers to hear that, too. I think they'd want to know that. So, a very interesting perspective, and I respect your views and your judgmental approach to living your life. Any powerlifting judging in your future?
I don't know that I will tell you that anymore based upon your reaction to bodybuilding judging. So
okay.
We'll just, I'm going to play those cards a little closer to my chest, considering there's a distinct effort to get me canceled on my own company show.
Oh, no, not canceled, just chided and
shamed
and, you know, just get some hate mail in. I know we've all been on the receiving end of some good hate mail, and I feel like it's your turn, you know? It's been a while for you.
Well, hate mail is a zero-sum game. People only have time to send so much hate mail. So if I can share the burden, I'm just doing my part.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to be busy. You've got some seminars and presentations. I got a few coming up. I am very excited this weekend. I'm going to be presenting at a conference at Duke University, and one of the other presenters is Coach K. Between the two of us, we have 5 national titles and I believe 13 Final Four appearances, 3 Naismith Coach of the Year awards. Not going to go into detail about how we divvy those up between the two of us, but yeah, this is a big deal. He's like the biggest name you could possibly get in these parts. So that'll be a really cool conference. We're going to be talking about the applications of doubly labeled water for sports nutrition. And doubly labeled water is really cool because most people who are familiar with it know that it is a nice indicator of energy expenditure, total energy expenditure throughout the day when you're out living your normal life, doing your normal training. So for athletic purposes, that's huge. That tells you so much more than just like getting into the lab and doing a resting metabolic rate. It even tells you a heck of a lot more than having someone stay in a metabolic chamber for 24 hours because they're not going up and down the court all day like they normally do in their day-to-day life. So that's obvious, but doubly labeled water is cool because you can also get really good water turnover data. So you can get an idea of how much fluids a person should be ingesting every day between food and beverage. Always important when you see those recommendations about how much fluid you should have, that does include food, which often has a pretty substantial proportion of your total fluid for the day. And another cool thing about doubly labeled water is if people are relatively weight stable during that period, you can actually get a decent indicator of how much they're eating as well, you know, which is pretty cool because you can kind of work your math backwards. And the reason that's valuable is because we know that even the most knowledgeable and highly motivated people still tend to have erroneous reporting in their food records. You know, I think there's been even studies with registered dietitians, which is the highest nutrition credential you could have in the United States, and they were still off by 20%. Like, it's literally the population that would be least likely to have any type of reporting errors in their diet logs.
I think it might have been 200 calories.
Okay, well, we'll have to go and fact check, but I tell you what, if you correct me and you're wrong, I am going to triple the hate mail coming your way. But
what if I'm right?
Well, then, you know, we'll ignore it. We'll move past it. No big. We're not betting on this. I'm just saying, you know, okay. when you have the gall to judge other people's bodies and then correct people without a high level of confidence in your information, then that's the risk you take.
Got it.
But anyway, yeah, doubly labeled water, super cool. And I don't know enough about how it's produced to know if it will ever be like truly affordable for regular use in applied settings. But man, that would be super cool. I need to figure out what the major constraint on affordable production is, and then, you know, whip up a big group of smart people to figure out how we fix that. Because right now, it's like, if you want to get 10 liters, it's going to run you about 30 grand. It ends up being about 3 grand a liter. And you need, for a dose, you need maybe about 100 milliliters. It scales by body mass, but that's a pretty average dose, 90-100 milliliter, 80 to 100 milliliters. So all that is to say, it's pretty expensive. That's the major limitation for practical application, but if somehow we can get that price down, it'd be pretty incredible as a tool that people could use. You know, our lab, before I joined, unfortunately, we did doubly labeled water because we do human research, but we've also done animal models and stuff like that. We did a study on elephants, and they needed an enormous dose of doubly labeled water. And the tricky thing is, like, doubly labeled water, it's like every drop is gold, right? So with animals, you know, you think of your dog lapping up a big bowl of doubly labeled water, getting it everywhere, right? And you're like, well, how much dose did you actually get? That really matters when we're looking at clearance rates over a 1 week period, right? Like we need a really precise measurement. And the more you leave on the rug in front of that water bowl, it's just money down the drain. So with elephants, what they did was they actually soaked loaves of bread in the doubly labeled water and then fed them the bread. And that's actually a pretty common way to do it with animals, is to kind of just soak the water into like a biscuit or a type of bread and feed them that. Anyway, yeah, it's pretty incredible what you can do there. So I'll be doing that. And then the College and Professional Sports Dietitians Association, they've got their annual meeting coming up in like a week, actually. I'm going to be at that one too in Missouri, if you happen to be around in Kansas City. And I'm going to be talking about metabolic adaptation. Here's the question, Helms. Is it a myth?
You know, I've seen publications that have claimed it is a myth while also quantifying the actual amount of the mythical proportion that occurred. I think you reviewed that in Mass, if I recall correctly.
I sure did. Yeah. And you know what? For our opening segment, I actually think that might be an interesting like little chat to have of, is metabolic adaptation a myth? And I'm not going to go all the way into all the details and stuff, but you know, we like to open with a segment, get the show going, let people populate some questions in the live chat. So I think
before we do that, can I point out that I should not be receiving more hate mail based upon my correction? So 2002, Champagne and colleagues, energy intake and energy expenditure control study comparing dietitians and non-dietitians. The energy intake of the controls and the dietitians, as they estimated it, was underreported by the non-dietitians by about 429 plus or minus 142 kcals per day. The dietitians, 223 plus or minus 116 kcals per day.
Mm.
So I did remember that random nugget in my head, which is about a 10% difference, which is why I felt the need to speak it up. But it is closer to 20% for the controls.
Right, but I think what I was referring to is, If you would have doubled that, then it would have been 20%. I'm pretty sure where I was going with that. That was the, let's not get bogged down in the details. Okay, let's just move past it. Like I said previously.
Got it. Sounds good.
All right. So I think it's actually really valuable to talk about this idea. Like, there was that paper, I covered it in Mass, and the question was, is metabolic adaptation a myth or an illusion? An illusion is the word that they used in the title. And while I disagree with the assertion that it's an illusion, I do enjoy that paper, and I like that paper because I think it highlights a huge disconnect between how different researchers in the field talk about metabolic adaptation. Now, the reason that's important for something like mass office hours is because you may, as a listener, be sitting there and see some interview with this researcher saying, actually, metabolic adaptation is a myth, and it's an illusion, and it's not real. And then you see one with a hack like me or Helms, and we're saying, actually, it's not. It's like kind of real. And that can be something that's really frustrating. It causes a lot of confusion, a lot of, a lot of uncertainty about how you should proceed in terms of your understanding of this topic. So the biggest disconnect, in my opinion, the kind of root cause of all of this disagreement about metabolic adaptation being a myth or an illusion is, what do you mean by metabolic adaptation, right? Mm-hmm. So Helms, if someone were to ask, no need for a hypothetical, I'll ask you. If someone is deep in the throes of a high magnitude of metabolic adaptation, what compartment of their energy expenditure is primarily being impacted?
I'm going to guess non-exercise activity thermogenesis based upon the data I've seen.
Right. So non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is not resting metabolic rate, it is not basal metabolic rate. And one of the best review papers on this topic from 2010 by Rosenbaum and Liebel, we'll call him Liebel just to make sure we're not calling him the name of a crime. So Liebel.
Yeah, you don't want to libel him by mislabeling his name. Liebel is libel.
Exactly. Yeah, trying to stay on the straight and narrow here. So Rosenbaum and Liebel, great review paper back in 2010, and they estimate that what we see as metabolic adaptation, the actual adaptive dip, greater than anticipated drop in total daily energy expenditure, they expect that or estimate that about 85 to 90% of that is actually coming from non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So it's not just the primary compartment. It is like almost the whole thing is coming from non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Like I said, maybe up to 90% of the effect, which means everything else left over is just kind of the loose change that you find in the couch cushions, right? Now, when you look at a lot of the research on metabolic adaptation, especially within the last several years, metabolic adaptation, and to their credit, the authors usually make this extremely clear in their methods, they quantify it specifically looking at basal or resting metabolic rate. They say, compared to what your resting metabolic rate should be based on predictions, how much lower than that are we actually measuring it to be? And that gap between predicted resting metabolic rate and actual measured resting metabolic rate is being framed as metabolic adaptation. So there are these two kind of dueling definitions that are floating around out there in the literature about what we're actually referring to. Now, it's totally fine to set your own operational definition. And the reason that a lot of people focus on resting metabolic rate, it's no secret. Resting metabolic rate is by far the easiest compartment of total daily energy expenditure to measure. It's even easier to measure than total energy expenditure, right? Resting is as easy as it gets. Non-exercise activity thermogenesis is, I would say, by far the most challenging. Like, it is immensely difficult to quantify in a reliable manner. It is so hard to measure because it's all these extra calories that are being spent on activities of daily living when people are not hooked up to an indirect calorimeter. We're not collecting their breathing gases. If we are collecting those, they're probably in a metabolic chamber where we are then changing their activities of daily living, because most people don't confine their entire life to a 12 by 12 foot box unless, they're incarcerated. There's not a lot of people who are sticking into this little tiny area. And even then, you still have times throughout the day where you're going to lunch, things like that. Not going to pretend to know the intricacies of the daily schedule in penal systems across the entire world, but it's a very unnatural restriction of your daily activity to stay in a chamber that is the size of literally a small dormitory, if that, for 24 hours straight or 23 hours straight. So even the numbers we get there are not great. And then the final thing I'll mention is sometimes people will say, well, let's just kind of throw an accelerometer on somebody and just see generally how much they're moving, right? And that should tell us roughly how much their non-exercise activity thermogenesis ought to be. You know, we should be able to roughly estimate it based on accelerometry or step count or something like that. But that's actually a really gross oversimplification of non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So that can tell us a lot about NEPA, N-E-P-A, non-exercise physical activity. But when we're talking about thermogenesis, we're talking about a unit of energy, not a unit of activity. So what you have to do is make tremendous assumptions when you're converting a physical activity metric to an estimate of non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Some of the incredible work by Rosenbaum and Liebel's group, what they found is that people that are experiencing considerable metabolic adaptation, people who have lost more than 10% of their body mass and then are weight stable, which is important, they, when they're doing low-intensity physical activity, it appears that they become considerably more efficient. So what that means is, even if you kept your step count the same, the energy burned per step changes, okay? And so your physical activity would then be overestimating your non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and that doesn't even account for things like fidgeting and things like differences in the maintenance of posture, which actually matter a lot, right? Like, I don't know about you, Holmes. I know for me, like my posture visibly, noticeably changes when I'm prepping, especially deep in prep for a bodybuilding competition. I am not upright and I move like these little tiny things that even in a metabolic chamber with radar detectors and things like that can still be difficult to really, really accurately, precisely measure. So all that is to say, non-exercise activity thermogenesis is super hard to measure and quantify, which is why in a lot of these studies, people focus on resting metabolic rate. But that is where this idea of the myth or the illusion comes into play. So what we know about resting metabolic rate, let's say we do a weight loss study, Helms and Trexler et al. We have these folks lose some weight, and at the end of that study, we measure their resting metabolic rate right on the last day of this weight loss intervention. And it is way below what we would have predicted, right? So we can run our calculations and we go, whoa, there's a gap of 150 calories maybe. The question is, what's causing that difference between predicted and measured? Now, Helms, we get a nasty letter to the editor saying, you fools, you dummies did not measure them in a weight stable state. You know, they were still in a calorie deficit on the tail end of that weight loss phase, and being in a deficit will suppress resting metabolic rate. And so the paper arguing that metabolic adaptation is mostly an illusion, even though they still measured a statistically significant degree of suppressed metabolic resting metabolic rate, what they found was that the magnitude of that suppression being lower than predicted, that shrunk considerably when people were taken from an active weight loss state to a weight neutral or weight stable state. So that is where a lot of this stuff comes from when people say, oh, metabolic adaptation, that's just a myth. Once you get to neutral energy balance, it goes away. Well, even that's not true. It shrinks, but even in that study, it was still present and statistically significant. Now, another place where people kind of pile on to this idea that metabolic adaptation is a myth or an illusion is actually a really good science. It's really brilliant stuff. It's accounting for organ mass. Mm-hmm. Now, Helms, you know, people always say, there's like that cliche, if you want to really get lean, you got to gain some muscle and you'll be, at rest, you'll be this calorie burning machine, right? And it's because of the I think most people know that muscle at rest, it just takes more calories to sustain. It burns more calories at rest than fat mass, right? So you look at someone with high body fat and low muscularity versus someone with high muscularity and low body fat, very, very different resting energy expenditure per kilogram of body mass, right? But organs are like metabolic machines, man. I mean, we're talking about 10 and 20-fold higher metabolic rates per kilogram of mass when compared to muscle tissue. So if you are dieting, there's actually a pretty good chance that you will have non-negligible reductions in the size of some of your organs. You might find that your kidneys, heart, liver actually do change in size a little bit. You might find that there's some atrophy of potentially gastric tissues. You might find that, you know, in your weight-reduced state, maybe your brain burns fewer calories per day. I'm not entirely certain. That'd be tremendously hard to measure, but the main point there is that when you actually try to at least correlate for changes in size of some of these organs, when you try to account for that, what we find is that that degree of resting metabolic rate suppression shrinks even more. We find that those predictions, if they're not considering organ by organ masses, they're leading us a little bit astray. So when you account for the energy deficit, metabolic adaptation of the resting compartment shrinks. When you account for losses in organ mass, it shrinks even more. There's still this little tiny residual, but we've known for almost 30 years now, based on meta-analyses, that if you want to look at the resting metabolic rate of someone who has reduced their body weight by at least 5 or 10%, maybe it's 3% lower than you would predict. Like, I mean, we're talking about a couple or a few percentage points. So when folks say that, hey, like, we can actually explain away most of this suppression resting metabolic rate, that is not necessarily surprising. That is validating what we see when we zoom out and just compare two people of similar body size. One person's been that weight their whole adult life, and the other person used to be 30 pounds heavier. When we look at those like very basic cross-sectional comparisons, we pretty much don't see a huge difference in resting metabolic rate. It usually is not particularly large, just a couple percentage points. However, non-exercise activity thermogenesis is really where a lot of the metabolic adaptation is occurring. So that's why there's this huge disconnect when scientists talk about this term. A lot of times they're using it interchangeably to discuss very, very, very different things. And so you can look at, you could ask me like, hey, is my resting metabolic rate going to be dramatically lower than predicted if we use the absolute best of the best measurement techniques and controls? I would say no. Will I still likely be experiencing metabolic adaptation if I lose 15% of my body mass? Likely so, but it will probably be in the really difficult to measure non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And that's where it gets really interesting, is getting back to that example, Helms, where we compare two people, similar body size, same biological sex. One person has been that weight their whole life. The other person has lost 30 pounds to get there. Their resting metabolic rate is only going to be different by a few percentage points. Their total daily energy expenditure could be different by maybe up to 300 calories. And the question is, well, where is that coming from? It's not resting. It's being more efficient during exercise, and it's especially being more efficient during non-exercise activity. So just a little aside about hopefully clarifying some of the confusion there. And at the end of the day, just to make this a little more practical, people ask, well, what do we do about that? For now, we're not really sure, in my opinion, Helms. I mean, I think one of the most important things you can do with metabolic adaptation is know about it, be aware of it, plan for it, don't get discouraged by it. You know, one of the biggest things that we see in folks who don't follow a lot of evidence-based fitness content, they start doing things that should induce weight loss. The weight loss is surprisingly low because they're not aware of some of these things like metabolic adaptation, exercise energy compensation, things of that nature. And the first thing they think is something's wrong with me. Like something is not okay here. I need to go get a whole, you know, endocrine workup, you know, look at my thyroid hormone. You know, there's some kind of endocrine issue that is pumping the brakes on my weight loss efforts. Just knowing that this is part of the process and that incremental changes are needed can actually go a really long way in maintaining your sanity and, you know, keeping that progress moving straight ahead. Now, then there's the controversial stuff, Helms. Beyond doing that, you know, things like refeeds and diet breaks. And where are you currently at on the potential utility of refeeds and diet breaks? Because that's an ever-changing literature. It's a literature where my position has changed considerably over the years. So where are you at with refeeds and diet breaks as they pertain to metabolic adaptation specifically?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. I think one way to look at it is we know that metabolic adaptation overlaps a lot with REDS,
mm-hmm.
Red S, relative energy deficiency in sport. And that is just fundamentally in a concept of, are you consuming enough relative to your energy expenditure and your lean body mass to not have these adaptations, which include and encompass metabolic adaptation? It just describes the experience, the impact on performance, the impact on health, and then what components does that occur from, for the most part. Of course, there are some distinctions there as well, but I think there's a tremendous amount of overlap in those two Venn diagrams. And I see intermittent dieting strategies, at the very least, as methods of essentially slowing down the rate of weight loss. And I would suspect that over the long term, either whether you do continuous dieting to have a smaller energy gap and therefore maintain a higher energy availability, or if you take an intermittent approach, they're probably going to have net aggregate effects on the magnitude and the rate and which features of REDS you might develop due to low energy availability. With that said, we simply don't have data on people using diet breaks or refeeds while experiencing substantial symptoms of REDS / metabolic adaptation. And I think while I'm not necessarily super hopeful or expecting that that'll be a really, really useful tool, I have enough anecdotal experience to think it's certainly possible, because people in deeper places of prep who have lost more weight, you could make a mechanistic rationale, and I can share my anecdotal experience that they seem to get a disproportionate benefit from a transient increase in calories than those who are not in that state. So, yeah, it could obviously be psychologically driven, and we do have data to support that as well. In fact, the only beneficial thing that we see consistently in the diet break studies is, depending upon which lab group study you're looking at, less disinhibition, which is just a weird way of saying not as driven to binge eat or desire overeating foods, or better appetite regulation. So essentially making the process easier, if you will. And then in the burn study, which kind of first prompted the whole idea of diet breaks, which was an outpatient, give people food kind of approach, we saw better weight loss and better weight loss maintenance, which could be related to those features. And it was really just a reporting issue as to whether or not they were actually consuming the same amount. So yeah, I think that's kind of where I'm at with it. But I would really like to see some research on people getting not only really lean, because that would, you know, exacerbate all these issues being below your lower intervention point, but also dieting long enough or losing enough weight or the combination of both, or being in a large enough energy gap or low enough energy availability that we would anticipate we'd be seeing some of these metabolic adaptations, which perhaps these intermittent dieting strategies could mitigate to some degree.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic point. Like, I used to be really, really optimistic about refeeds and diet breaks for having, you know, very dramatic physiological effects. And I've really, as the research has come out, some of which I've been a part of, I said, okay, yeah, I'm ready to kind of ease up on that optimism. But I do think people were a little too quick to say, oh, so these things are totally useless, right? Because when you look at some of the studies, to your point, that have really put these to the test, we're talking about people who are lean but not shredded, and they're losing maybe a couple kilograms during the course of the study. They're not in large energy deficits. They're not losing a tremendous amount of fat mass to the extent that you'd see dramatic reductions in leptin levels. So it's kind of like, Helms, you know anything about shark repellent?
I do not, but I've heard this analogy before. Then go ahead.
So there is I've heard, I haven't looked this up, so I might be getting duped, and I'm okay with that because I don't swim in the ocean. But I've heard that there is a compound or a molecule that is produced by decomposing shark tissue. And apparently sharks, when they detect that in the water, they get the hell out of the way, which would make sense, right?
Some of the bigger predators out there.
Yeah, for some reason, sharks come here to die, and I don't want to be one of them. So I'm getting out, right? And I have seen videos, which may or may not be valid, where they put a few drops of this in the water when they're feeding sharks and there's a whole frenzy going on and they just scram, like, instantly. So I might be getting duped. Don't take my advice on avoiding shark attacks. My best advice is don't get in water where there may be sharks. I feel pretty good about that. But, you know, I could take shark repellent. There's a lake about 10 minutes from me where I like to paddleboard and kayak. And if I tested that shark repellent versus a placebo, my results, you know, would be null. I'd say, well, that didn't work any better than a placebo because I tested it in a water where I hope to God there are no sharks. It is a freshwater lake. And, you know, I've used a similar analogy with like bee repellent, right? Well, there's got to be bees around if you're going to actually detect an effect of this repellent. Otherwise, of course, it won't be better than a placebo. No one's getting stung. So all that is to say, like, some of these refeed and diet break trials, not to bash them, it's important to start with the most feasible study we can, you know, and then kind of build from there. But the reality is we have not really put these things to the test in the situations where they would be most likely to shine, right? We kind of need that. We've already got the kind of feasibility-oriented studies, which have been done, but I think we need that, like, really intense proof-of-principle study where we say, okay, we're not going to go all the way Minnesota starvation experiment, but hey, let's find some folks that are really pushing it here and let's see if we can make this happen and look at the psychological, the behavioral, and the physiological elements. And I am increasingly leaning toward the conclusion that the physiological elements, specifically pertaining to energy expenditure regulation, I think that's just going to come down to the cumulative energy deficit over time. You know, like you said, kind of the energy availability in a more cumulative sense over time. But when it comes to behavioral stuff, when it comes to psychological stuff, when it comes to training quality on certain days that are kind of most closely temporally close to those higher calorie periods, I think there could be, you know, some detectable differences in whether or not they're meaningful. Well, that's kind of in the eye of the beholder, isn't it, Helms, right? So what may be meaningful to someone who's trying to go from third in the world to first is going to look a lot different from someone who is trying to lose 40 pounds, you know, that extra kilogram and a half is not gonna make or break whether or not they assess their weight loss endeavor as a success or a failure, right?
Totally agree.
All right. So Helms, oh yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a couple things on the metabolic adaptation. I think the definition of this is less energy expenditure than we would predict and we have an unexplained reduction, I think is a really useful definition when we don't have a complete set of methods to reductionist step-by-step measure every single one of those things. And I kind of wish people would, in the research world, adopt that a little bit more because it better aligns with anecdotes. And when we pretend that we can measure them all and we take shots at, I don't know, we're not seeing metabolic adaptation, it can be misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. A common misinterpretation of some of these papers that questions the existence of metabolic adaptation is then to lean really hard into, you know, all the people who are out here struggling with weight loss and think that they're consuming X amount of calories, they're actually definitely overestimating their caloric intake and they're underestimating their caloric intake and they're overestimating their caloric expenditure. And on average, people certainly do. And we have really good data on that to a large degree. And it does explain probably a majority of kind of head-scratching numeric numbers where you're not losing as much weight as you want. But I think if you've been in the game long enough, especially when you work with really neurotic people who, if anything, are probably going to overestimate their calorie intake out of fear for getting it wrong. You see enough outlier cases consistently where you're like, something's going on here. And to some degree, understanding that it is just energy expenditure adaptation kind of makes it okay for the more pedantic people. Because I have heard some hot takes that I think are wrong, they are factually correct, but they are wrong as far as what do they imply for application. So, for example, it's all neat. That just means people are being lazy. We need to up the step count. Well, no. Like you said, neat thermogenesis, that actually means skeletal muscle efficiency, burning less calories, doing the same amount of visible or experienced activity. Likewise, okay, it's not actually a reduction in your resting metabolic rate when we account for organ tissue losses, but how much agency do we have over preventing organ tissue losses? I mean,
just be better and don't lose organ mass when you're losing weight. Yeah.
Do a better job of maintaining your liver size, right? Or eat more food so that you actually get your smooth muscle to contract. Wait, I can't. I have to diet, right? So I do, hell, maybe there's something to then eating those very high protein intakes that seem to not stimulate muscle protein synthesis, but do stimulate whole body muscle protein turnover. And my recommendation from 2012 was right, but not for your muscle, for your liver. We shall see. But I think I have seen takes based both upon the organ mass and related to the NEAT component that kind of basically go, listen, like this isn't metabolic adaptation. What everyone's thinking, they've got it wrong. But ultimately, the question is, how much agency do you have over what you do? And you can't change skeletal muscle efficiency, and you can't change losses of organ mass, and it's not really relevant, the specific mechanism, except for potential interventions that may have very targeted, you know, approaches, which, of course, we still need to know this, but we also need to get the message out more publicly that, listen, you're going to burn less calories than anticipated, and here's the potential quantification of that, and here's the span of it, here's where most people fall, but here are some outliers. And I think that's valuable, because I've seen a lot of times some of the stuff dismissed and potentially mislabeled as just mistracking energy output or energy intake.
Yeah, and nothing can be more discouraging as a client if you're working with a coach and you are doing, you know, you are making an earnest effort toward tracking everything accurately, and they say, hey, you got to quit lying to me, right? And like there are these other things that are, it's not just that they could be happening, it's that we have pretty good evidence to indicate that they are happening, right? And so it's really important to know those things. We did have a comment in the live chat here. Someone was saying, so basically if I'm a hard gainer, then I should just get smaller organs and then it'll be easier to build mass, right? So I do find it funny. Someone once, when I was talking about this, asked like, hey, do you know like any way that I can make my organs bigger? And I was like, oh, I know ways, but they all make your life shorter. So,
yeah.
You do not want to hypertrophy your organs. Yeah, it's just one of those things that, like you said, it is so like simultaneously true, but also pedantic and useless to say like, oh, well, just account for organ loss. But again, what are you going to do about it? Like it doesn't really matter to you if it's a mysterious adaptation or a change in mitochondrial efficiency, or if it's a drop in liver and heart and kidney size. At the end of the day, you have to deal with it and there's nothing you can do about it, right? So that they all kind of lead you to the same place.
100%.
All right, Helms, I need to do my announcements. We're 40 minutes in. I haven't done the basic stuff that I kick off the show with. So now we will start. Hey, folks, if you like the show, make sure you like, rate, subscribe, review, wherever you happen to get it. Tell a friend, share a link to the YouTube or the Spotify, the Apple Podcast account. The more people, the merrier. If you like the show and you want to support us, of course, joining us live on YouTube Wednesday nights, 7 p.m. Eastern time. That is the best way to do it. Although I should note, next week, we will not be live. We will have an episode. It'll be a pre-recorded video. As I mentioned previously, I've got like two conferences to present at this week. So I am going to be literally on a plane during our typical live recording time. So next week will be pre-recorded, but we think you're really going to like that video. If you want to submit questions when we're not live and we're not in the live chat, you can go to massresearchreview.com/officehours. And of course, the number one way to support what we're doing here, The Mass Research Review makes all this possible. If you like the type of stuff we talk about, you should check out the Mass Research Review at massresearchreview.com and consider becoming a subscriber. You get access to all of our new content and now 7 years worth of archived content covering the most practical questions in fitness, always with a very science-based approach, talking about the newest research in the area. Helms, I wanted to answer a couple quick questions that have been building up in our after-hours, 24-hour question portal here. A couple interesting ones that that I think are worth a few minutes on the show. So one of them was a question for Eric. I'm assuming this is the Eric's. Friends of mine started consuming essential amino acids instead of protein shakes for convenience. Their logic is that the other amino acids can be made by the body, so no need to eat all that protein. Why bother? I'll just eat the essential amino acids and, get all the growth for a fraction of the calories and a fraction of the protein intake. So the question...
That is the price.
Yes, that is true. So the person asking the question is, my feeling is this cannot be true. Can you help us settle this debate? Now, Helms, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that the human... muscle amino acid profile, it contains a combination of essential and non-essential amino acids, correct?
It does.
Right. And so what that means is it is true that essential amino acids are the ones you cannot produce. You need to get them from your diet. You can produce the other ones, but big catch here, you got to make them out of something, right? And so
it's amazing how many people miss that point. Like,
yeah,
yes, not essential, but where do you think it gets made? It's not a little factory that sits in your living room.
Yeah. Well, it'd be great if you just turned all of your subcutaneous adipose fat into those amino acids that you need. But based on my biochemistry textbooks over there, I'm thinking that's not the case. Right. So at the end of the day, you have an issue of raw material. So if you decided that you were going to cheat the system and go all essential amino acids, you would essentially be borrowing from them in a number of cases to try to make some of these non-essential amino acids that are nutritionally non-essential, but for the function of a human body do need to be created in order for everything to function well. So all of that is to say, at a certain point, you're just not going to have enough raw materials and nitrogen-related compounds floating around to actually make what you need, and it would eventually hinder you if you tried to take this strategy to the extreme and say, like, instead of having 180 grams a day of typical normal proteins, I'm only going to eat, 70 grams a day of essential amino acids. It's just not going to work out the way that your friends think it will. Best option, in my opinion, is eat a varied diet, eat enough total daily protein that is appropriate for your goals. If you have any medical conditions, obviously scale to that as indicated by a medical professional. But I really don't think that there's a good way to cheat the system here. The only time that I think it makes sense to try to, put your thumb on the scale in terms of essential versus non-essential amino acids would be if, for example, there is some reason that you cannot eat enough total daily protein to support your goal. So, like, let's say that your goal was to build as much muscle as possible, but due to a medical condition, due to the cost, protein's expensive, could be a cost thing. It could just be that you don't really like eating protein and you find that you're consistently consuming only 1 gram of protein per kilogram of body mass per day, largely from plant-based sources. At that point, I would say, hey, whether it's through whey protein or some other kind of protein, like some kind of protein blend that gets a nice mixture of essential amino acids, like you probably do want to think about protein quality and essential amino acid intake if you're in that kind of position where you have these bodybuilding adjacent goals, but you're really under eating protein and a high proportion of your protein is coming from relatively low quality sources. But outside of that, I would say, if you don't have constraints that are limiting your ability to eat an adequate amount of just total protein from fairly typical sources, I would say that's your best bet. What do you think, Helms?
No, I think you covered that in plenty of depth.
All right. There was one other one here that I wanted to cover from the chat. Yeah, I think it was this one. So when I'm on a cut, let's say I'm at 7 p.m., okay? I hit my calorie target for the day. I'm out of calories, but I'm still below my protein target. Would it be better to consume a protein shake to reach my protein target and go over my calories, or should I just stop eating for the day and accept the fact that I didn't hit my protein target? What do you think, Helms?
I think it depends on how far below their protein target is and what their protein target is. So if they're kind of taking the wild and wacky approach of Eric Trexler, who would dare to point out that being in the 1.4 to 1.59 grams per kilogram range is statistically almost identical to being over 1.6, and daring to point out that optimal and nearly optimal are actually quite similar quantitatively, then I would say, listen, if you're already skirting that low end, if you're playing with fire, due to Trex, barely holding on to your muscle mass,
the most overdramatic.
Yeah, then maybe you would. I would probably have a small amount of protein. I think this is going to matter very little if you're still within a reasonable protein range. Let's say you finish the day and you're like, oh shit, I'm only at 1.4 grams per kg, but I'm at my calorie target. I'd say just go to bed, right? However, if you're only aiming for 1.4 and you're at 1 gram per kilogram, and this is something that happens once or twice a week, then I would probably opt to get throw some whey in a cup, get 20 grams down, and it'll potentially, and although we are splitting hairs, be a better outcome. You'll be at a smaller deficit, but you would think that reduction in calories is not going to do a whole lot for fat mass. It might do a little something for muscle mass retention. Because there could be a scenario here where you might lose a similar or greater amount of weight, but the composition is starting to skew unfavorably towards lean mass losses.
Good stuff. I totally agree. It's all about the context and all about the magnitudes in terms of what the right choice is going to be there. We got folks tuning in from Santa Cruz. We've got folks tuning in from, I'm pretty sure I saw Brazil in there. And of course, we've got the hashtags coming in. Sharkatrex, relating to my...
That was a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Earlier, I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, we've got Coach Shatresky playing off the Coach Krzyzewski with our big event this weekend. Helms, any good ones for you? I feel like, Helms, your name doesn't lend itself to as many fun hashtags, and that's not an insult. It's just Trex is such a good building block for this stuff. It just seems to be. But we'll keep scouring. Get your hashtags in. Let us know where you're viewing from. We always love to hear from the good people in the live chat. And I did want to ask the first question here. We got to address it. The people want to know. This actually comes up a lot. This comes up a lot in the fitness space. And it's not, I would not consider it fitness related, but obviously it is fitness adjacent. Question is, how do you guys deal with hair loss? I'm about to turn 30 and still going strong, but I suspect the end is near in my 40s. I am offended that someone watching this on YouTube would ask me how I am dealing with hair loss.
Not well.
Well, I think it's going fine. So here's what I want to tell you, person whose name is YouTube account. When I was in my early 20s, I went to family reunions. I saw the family tree. I knew that hair was not going to be in my future, not for a while. So I started to, I really was like, oh, this is going to be so terrible. I really don't want to lose my hair. Let me tell you what, shaving your head is incredible. Like, there's no such thing as a bad hair day. You save about $1 million over your lifetime on haircuts. If you put that into a nice index fund with compounding interest.
Really nice fund.
It's real. I mean, you get the one of the electric hair shavers. You do it two or three times a week. Honestly, shaving my head is so much better than I thought. And if you can grow a beard just to kind of make your face interesting, adorn it, get a beard going, throw some glasses on, maybe some thicker frames than you used to have. honestly, I want to tell you, it's not all that bad. Helms, do you have any interest in addressing the topic, or do you think I covered it well enough?
I think you did great, and I think we have some other better questions to address that are
okay.
More useful. By the way,
there's nothing more useful than giving people hope, Helms, and I want them to know it's not that bad, folks.
Absolutely. I have had a receding hairline since I was 19, and fortunately, I have stopped the recession. But I'm also getting more and more comfortable just not looking like I'm 19 anymore as I get to 41. So
crazy how that happens. Let's get it. We got a really good one here. Hamstrings. Helms, you love hamstrings, right?
I do.
So Josh was asking, what are some closed chain exercises that are good for hamstring development? Or I would just say we can expand this out. Helms, you've got great leg development. What kind of hamstring exercises are kind of top of the list for you?
Well, since the person did specifically ask about closed chain, the most obvious ones, in my opinion, are RDL and good morning. And I think the RDL is one of the best. Deadlifts are generally great for hamstring development, but because they start from the floor and because they are a pretty heavy movement that people often think strength with, they often result in a relatively uncontrolled eccentric. The RDL, I think the best way to perform it is out of the rack and with a range of motion to where you are still getting hip flexion. Visible when viewed from the side by your hips actually moving backwards. You can keep going, but then you're typically just getting lumbar movement and you're not really lengthening the hamstring anymore at that point. So you kind of want to watch to see at which point does the hamstring stop lengthening. And another really good cue is to not allow your knees to track forward at all, because a lot of people kind of squat their RDLs a little bit. Good mornings are an excellent teaching tool for how to do RDLs properly, because you can tell immediately when you start squatting. It feels really, really funky to go past the point with a bar on your back to where you're not extending the hip backwards anymore and you're actually just flexing your spine. And if you view an RDL and a good morning from the side done properly, they put you in the same position. And the difference is just that the bar is right over your scapula sitting on top of them in a good morning, or in your hands, in your arms, attached to your scapula in the same plane. So they should produce very similar outcomes. There is, of course, more requirement to support the bar with different muscles, et cetera, grip constraints. But some people just have a really tough time learning the hip hinge, and I think a good morning is an excellent teaching tool. So I'm a big fan of both good mornings and RDLs for closed chain movements. You certainly can do regular deadlifts, but you want to control the eccentric. And because there is a greater degree of knee extension and quad involvement, moving from the ground all the way up, you're going to get a little less hamstring development and a little more balanced overall kind of development doing traditional deadlifts. So those are the closed chain movements. As far as open chain, you basically got your stock standard leg curls or your GHRs. And based upon the data we have, if you're specifically interested in the traditional hamstrings group, we probably want to see seated hamstring curls as they lengthen those. However, lying hamstring curls, I think we call them hamstring curls versus leg curls. I think, yes, that's better for hamstrings. However, it's worth noting that in lying hamstring curls, you are lengthening some knee flexors, albeit weak knee flexors like the sartorius that attach on the front of the hip. And we actually see better sartorius growth in lying hamstring curls, because if they're on the front of your body and you're lying down with your body straight, unlike being in hip flexion, being in hip extension, it's more lengthened. So just be aware, if you want to start playing with longer muscle length manipulations, that you have a pretty comprehensive understanding of functional anatomy so you don't accidentally miss something. So anyway, hamstring curls, RDL, good mornings, those are the top of the book for me. If you don't have access to hamstring curls, GHR is an option. If you don't have access to GHR, if you have a buddy, simply doing Nordics, or even something I learned during COVID, is if you weight down the bed or a couch significantly and you can wedge your feet underneath it. You can do Nordics. And that's just the eccentric component of a hamstring curl, which will get probably the same bang for your buck, and you just try to control it as much as you can. So yeah, those are really good go-to hamstring exercises.
Yeah. COVID was a disaster. It was a tragedy. It was terrible. But the Nordic hamstring curl really took that opportunity to raise its status. You know,
that's right.
I think a lot of people during COVID were like, okay, I've got most of my stuff figured out. I've got 3 rubber bands, a gallon of milk, and a 40-pound dumbbell. What am I going to do for hamstrings? And the Nordic hamstring curl and the banded lying hamstring curl really kept a lot of people sane during COVID. So shout out to some of those more creative at-home exercises.
Shout out to the Nordic countries.
Absolutely. Innovators in exercise science. If you look at the history of our field, some of the best work back in the day, it all kind of started in those Nordic countries. So a tip of the cap. Now, we've got someone in the live chat. Their username is Call Me a Derp Last Name. So I don't think that's their, I don't think that's on their birth certificate, but they're having a big night because, first of all, they don't normally catch the show live, but tonight they did. They just recently subscribed to Mass, and they're a college student. And I want you to know what you learn from Mass will be tenfold more valuable than anything a university could possibly teach you. So you've made a tremendous investment into your knowledge and personal growth. And since it's such a big night for them, I wanted to address their question in the live chat. Their question was...
Can I point out one thing first, Rex?
Sure.
So, Call Me a Derp Last Name also said, big expense for a broke college kid, but worth. First off, thank you. Second off, if you're not aware, and we're just going to show you how bad a capitalist we are here in Mass, if you're signed up currently at our normal rates, do us a favor, email us with proof that you're actually still in university, because we do have university rates. We have, you know, the Mass for Students email, and you can get it at a cheaper rate, especially if this is an expense for you. You can get it down. I think what is it, $15 a month, Trex?
Approximately, which means I'm not sure. Again, yeah, going back to the bad capitalist thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're not already on those good rates, email us, we'll switch you over.
Absolutely. We do have a student discount for people who are currently students in university. Now, their question was, as someone who lost a significant amount of weight from 320 pounds down to 170, congratulations, that is really tremendous, and trying to get lower, I often wonder about satiety from food selection. Sometimes it feels like nothing fills me up. You just subscribed to Mass, and I want to tell you, we have many pieces of content about practical ways to promote satiety. Helms, you've written some of them. I've written many of them in recent years. And there are a lot of practical tips. I would encourage you to check out those articles to get the kind of full list. But it's worthwhile to mention a few things. I know we had one question in here about caffeine as an appetite suppressant from someone else. And Helms, you wrote a really great article about the fact that caffeine's reputation as an appetite suppressant is really overrated, and it doesn't seem to be really a particularly useful weight loss tool. And I've also, over the years, come to appreciate the fact that if you want to leverage it as a weight loss tool, because it's so ineffective, you often find that you go for more and more and more and more, especially as you start to habituate. And then you get to caffeine levels that are probably impairing your sleep, which in and of itself is bad for appetite regulation and weight loss. So it kind of puts you on a trajectory where I would feel comfortable from your article and from the sleep elements saying, let's not even think of caffeine as a fat loss facilitating tool. I would take that out of the toolbox. It has an application. Waking up and having a lovely cup of coffee, I love it as much as anyone else. Pre-exercise caffeine 30 to 60 minutes before a workout. There's some application there. As a fat loss tool, I'd leave it out of the conversation. Now, when it comes to food selection for satiety, the biggest one is going to be energy density, meaning foods that basically take up a big volume on your plate but don't bring a lot of calories. So thinking about foods with a lot of fiber content, a lot of water content, things like fruits and vegetables. Now, that's not across the board. There are certainly some fruits and vegetables that actually do have relatively high energy density, or at least much higher than others. So thinking about things that, like I said, huge food volume per calorie, that can be really helpful. Eating enough protein for your muscle building goals or muscle retention goals will probably put you in a range that is helpful to some extent for satiety. One of the things that goes under the radar a little bit with eating and trying to help navigate appetite, eating harder foods, things that require more chewing, things that kind of slow you down and force you to kind of savor the flavor a little bit more. And another one that goes under the radar a lot is eating foods that are palatable enough that you don't feel like you're making tremendous sacrifices. And when we say palatable, basically we mean they taste pretty good, but you don't want to have a huge portion of your diet coming from hyper palatable foods, foods that are just absolutely incredible, the kind of food that you view kind of as a treat in terms of how tasty it is. And I think this is an area where a lot of the natural bodybuilders about 10 years ago went totally off the rails. Everyone was thrilled about if it fits your macros, and then it kind of started this race to the bottom of people saying, how can I make the most delicious dessert-like meals that somehow have 35 grams of protein and not that many calories? And I think people were successful at that endeavor to their own detriment. And what I mean by that is people were having these hyper-palatable foods, but they were still in a calorically restricted diet, which really was a kind of agonizing juxtaposition of when that meal ends, it's like a tragedy. You're still physiologically hungry. You still have a tremendous desire to eat more. And I do think it kind of predisposed a lot of people to really unhealthy relationships with food, a lot of binge eating, or at least just a miserable time fighting off those urges to eat more after that meal is terminated. So when it comes to palatability, I think that there's a really fine balance where, like I said, you don't want your entire life to feel like this giant sacrifice. And, you know, you want to make sure that you're eating foods that are palatable enough. But I really do think from a behavioral perspective and from a neurophysiological perspective, you actually do find yourself in a slightly detrimental position when you are crafting these hyper-palatable meals, even if they fit your macros. So those are some of the satiety tips that come to the top of mind for me. Any that kind of make your short list that I left out there, Helms?
Nothing I could think of. It's basically you're looking at a overall appropriate energy intake, I think is a big piece of it. Appropriate macronutrient intake. Fiber content, energy density. So yeah. You want an overall low energy density in your diet. Anything that slows down your consumption so you get more time for the hunger signals to arrive, get a little bit of gastric stretch. Generally, I think an easy way to summarize what you said relating to the hyperpalatability is you mostly want to focus on foods that don't make you want to eat more of them when you eat them.
Right.
Right. And if you think about it, there's a lot of foods you like that don't necessarily drive additional consumption to the same degree as some of those foods that, you know, we literally have saying about them. Like, you can't eat just one blank, you know, chip, cookie, et cetera.
So, yeah. Definitely. Perfect. Yeah. So hopefully that'll be helpful. One thing I did want to mention, don't sleep on soup, folks. There are many types of soup that, you know, they take a while to eat. They've got this delicious savory broth that is surprisingly low calorie. You can get a lot of vegetables in there. The food volume tends to be high. So you can craft a pretty good soup that ends up checking a lot of these boxes. So don't forget that soup exists, because I did for a big portion of my life. It can be a nice little meal to mix things up there. All right, so let's see here. This is a question we see a lot about really high-frequency training. So if I have a set of dip bars at home and my goal is...
We're skipping a few here, Trex.
Okay, well, hey, I'm skipping around, but if you want to go in order, what do we got next here?
Yeah, there's one I saw a coach describing how weak bench press lockout is due to a weak back, allowing scaps to elevate, which shortens the triceps too much to be strong. Seems unlikely to me. Your expert's thoughts. So this is an example where I talked about how some anatomy knowledge is useful, but having extrapolations based upon limited anatomy knowledge and kind of building a house of cards can get you in trouble. So the little bit of anatomy knowledge that I think this coach might have is that the long head of the triceps do attach on the scapula. But here's the thing. The humerus also is connected there. So when you retract your scapula, the humerus moves backwards. So that means that you're not necessarily lengthening the long head, because the origin and the insertion, while one is on the scapula, the other is on the humerus, and they have a shared tendon. So you're not actually changing the distance there. So I would be surprised to think that scapular retraction, although I don't have like a modeling study, is lengthening or shortening the triceps to any significant degree. With that said, I have seen that some people who focus way too much on scapular retraction do have a little bit of trouble with lockout. I think the goal is not to maintain really, really tightly packed retraction and depression when benching. I think that generally stems from the narrative of, you know, you need to do that to protect shoulder health, which is probably a little too reductionist, and I don't think it's based on any hard data. However, you do want to create a stable base, and because your scapulae do move when pressing, it's a normal thing. If you were to do like a standing free motion cable press, part of the force production contribution would be from scapular protraction, not just horizontal abduction, shoulder flexion, and tricep extension, or elbow extension, I should say. So ideally, you want some degree of scapular protraction when you're pressing. But because you have a heavy weight in your hands when you're benching and you're laying on the bench, and if you're doing a powerlifting bench, you're also arching to some degree, trying to create a stable base of support and using a whole body approach, you're not going to get much scapular motion. And I think to create a stable base of support, you probably do want to do some retraction and depression of your scapula. But don't think that I need to maintain strict scapular depression and retraction for some kind of health reason. You are retracting and depressing your scapula to reduce the bar movement, though, right? It doesn't have to travel as far. But if a little bit of protraction happens at lockout, that's totally fine and probably a good thing. And it may be that you're this coach is ascribing a causation for something that might be a correlation. It may be that people who really overemphasize scapular retraction and depression are struggling at lockout, where you could actually protract a little bit and get a little oomph behind the bar, rather than something about retraction or a weak back causing to elevate and resulting in this tricep shortening. There's like three steps of logic here that the person is leaping to without having any kind of evidence to support it. And I think this is a great instance where we're not going to have data on something like this or modeling studies potentially. And some of the elements of this functional anatomy are accurate. But when you're relying on functional anatomy in the absence of empirical work, and there's a really good Iron Culture episode coming out with Coach Kasim from N1 where we talk about this, your confidence needs to be scaled to how much you are extrapolating based upon that functional anatomy. And you need to know to what degree you can go out there, and you need to have a complete understanding. So when you've seen someone take like there's three steps here, right? Okay, we got a weak back. Therefore, the weak back allows a scapula to elevate. That's claim one. Is that actually true? Like, if your back is weak, will your scapula elevate when you're benching? I don't know that to be true. And then that will shorten the triceps. I'm not sure that's true either, you know? And then that shortening of the triceps causes an issue for lockout. So I think that's the kind of thing where you want to really be skeptical when you hear those types of claims and think about what evidence can exist on this and what are they basing it on. So anyway, just want to address that one.
Absolutely. Yeah, good stuff. Someone in the chat said that this episode was doubly labeled Eric with a hashtag. That's a really good one.
That was good.
Now, we did skip one, Helms. So the Greek Trojan said, back in my paleo and keto days, I heard the theory that metabolic adaptation could be better thought of as metabolic efficiency, good for the body, but less good for your weight loss goal. Any validity to that notion? I would say, actually, yeah. Like metabolic adaptation, the thing that's really interesting about when we look at human physiology in a hypocaloric state is that there is a mixed bag of pros and cons of the adaptations that occur. And you can look at that in terms of survivability. It is broadly good for our species that in times of energy shortfalls, we do have some levers we can pull to kind of slow the loss of body tissue. When you look at from a cardiometabolic health perspective, there are some adaptations to an energy deficit or an energy shortfall that are quite advantageous. I think one of the most interesting papers on this that's worth Googling is by John Speakman, and he talks about what he calls the clean cupboards hypothesis. And it looks at a very, very extreme implementation of, let's say that I am dieting and I do start to not just be in a deficit, but I'm actually starting to get like pretty lean. Like I'm starting to get to a low body fat plus low energy intake relative to my expenditure. And then he talks a little bit more about some new pros and cons that enter the equation. So for example, we see all these positive things related to cardiometabolic outcomes and markers, things related to autophagy, things like that. But, you know, is your immune system really up to a mounting a robust response when you're lean and energy deprived? Are you going to heal wounds as well as you normally would? So there are some interesting trade-offs, but those usually don't enter the equation until we're getting to a pretty unique state of undernutrition. There are a mixture of pros and cons when you're in a metabolically adapted state. All right, Helms.
There's another quick one I think we missed that I want to address. Darren Coe, Dr. Darren Coe, PhD. Mm-hmm. I actually have seen him comment a few times and just want to appreciate him always vouching. Yeah. Darren, I could be wrong, but I think you are actually a mass subscriber. If you're not, my apologies for this suggestion. But I'm not the one to answer this question. Trex would have probably some insights. But he said, hey, how would either of you or both of you advise someone who wants to develop a running program along with their strength program, in parentheses, me? I'm not the person to answer. Trex does have a bit of a running background, but so does our own Dr. Mike Zurdos. And in mass, in his video content, he actually has a video back in volume 3, so we're digging in the crates, concurrent training for a marathon. And he actually goes over a time period in his life when he was competing in both powerlifting and marathon running and how you would organize this to mitigate potential concurrent training effects and how to organize it. And that you might find really useful, as well as the things he links there. And he actually has probably, I would say, 90% of the content on concurrent training and how you would mitigate any negative effect. I think that would be a really good resource if you are a mass subscriber. And if you're not, apologies for saying, hey, check out the stuff behind a paywall that you can't access.
Yeah, no, Helms, I will have you know that I did write the chapter on cardio for physique athletes in the NASM certification for bodybuilding coaching. So I am not the guy to go to for running performance, you know, if you're doing a performance-oriented program. But in terms of integrating cardio into a lifting program, there are some basic heuristics. I totally agree with Helms. Check out Zordos's content. And he might have even, Zordos has been on obviously a number of Office Hour episodes where we have addressed some running stuff. So it might not be a bad idea to check those archives as well. But the general thing that I would highlight, just in the most basic sense, work your way up in terms of volume and intensity with your running. I think the biggest issue a lot of people have is they try to do too much too soon. They're used to being an excellent lifter. And they say, well, I'm sure I could just go ahead and go to a very moderate running volume from zero. You really want to work your way up in terms of both, you know, in terms of volume, intensity, and frequency. So I would start small, you know, one or two low intensity, kind of shorter jogs per week, just to get your lower extremities kind of accustomed to, you know, running is a surprisingly high impact thing, you know, even if you're used to lifting pretty regularly. It's just a different type of impact. So I would say take your time, work your way up. And then when it comes to the timing of your sessions, ideally you're doing your cardio or your running days on off days, or you're just trying to strategically separate them from your lifting sessions. So if you can do them at least six-ish hours away from a lifting session, great. You know, if you're doing them both on the same day, if you can lift in the morning, run in the evening, I think that would be ideal personally if you're prioritizing lifting adaptations over running. But you just want to kind of strategically think about how, like, which one you're prioritizing, and then plan out your week accordingly. The one that you're prioritizing typically goes first, you know, but there's a few different ways that you can arrange that. So that's just kind of the broad strokes, or the kind of main things to think about is what's the top priority and how will I arrange this throughout the week so that the lower priority thing doesn't impair my progress on the higher priority thing, right? You're not going to find a professional marathoner who is doing a crazy lower body strength training session directly before their, you know, their most important run of the week. It's going to be a bad plan. So anyway, yeah, definitely would encourage you to check out some of Zordos's content within the Mass Research Review. All right, moving on here, we've got one from Anonymous. This is the one I'm seeing. Just did my first physique competition. Second one will be March 2025. Is improving for the next one really as simple as just doing a slow bulk, hitting weak points hard in the gym, and then doing my contest diet again? What do you think, Helms?
I think depends. Well, first, if you just did your first physique competition in 2024, and you're going to plan to compete again in March 2025, you may be one of those people who, especially if it's drug-free bodybuilding, you're going to look very potentially similar the next time, because it takes time to not only recover if you got lean enough for a bodybuilding competition, although you did say physique, so maybe you're in a less lean division potentially. And there's a reason why, especially early in people's competitive careers, unless maybe they've been lifting for years or huge and they just finally decided to take the plunge, where people take longer off seasons, multiple years. So, you know, you'll know those specifics as they apply to you better than I do. But when I deal with first-time competitors, I often encourage them to, when they first compete, it to be about the experience, figuring out if they like the sport and getting their feet wet and learning to live the lifestyle. And then we take a longer off season to build the muscle required for them to actually be more competitive subsequent seasons. But everyone's first-time experience is different. Another thing that often occurs for the most first-time competitors, they don't get lean enough. It's really friggin' hard. So, and depending upon how good, if you even got it, the feedback was from the judges, they may not be honestly or able to evaluate that what was holding you back was leanness. For example, I did a show in 2009 where one of the judges gave me feedback, and this is probably the last time I got judges' feedback, the reason I didn't get placed higher is I didn't have as many cuts in my muscle. I was like, okay, so I need to get leaner. And she said, no, I just want you to cut up the muscle you have. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, I think you need to do some higher reps just to give that muscle that cut look. You're already lean enough, but I also want to see more vascularity. And I think you should probably take some honey for the veins. And I think you were holding water, which also obscured it, so cut water. So she basically gave me the trifecta of, even in 2009, probably a decade out of date, incorrect advice of cut water, take honey for some reason, insert random food group that's supposed to have extremely untestable physiological visible effect, and don't lose weight. This does not have anything to do with fat. It's subcutaneous water and the fact that your muscle doesn't have cuts. So that was poor advice. And I went on to then place, going from placing second to first after I lost another 7 pounds. So it may be that it is not just as simple as improving your physique and getting into a slow bulk, and you actually just need to, or you would have placed higher if you were leaner, but we can't know that. There's a lot of things that go into placing better. Posing is also a huge component. So I think this might seem like a very simple question. Do I just get bigger and compete again? Well, sure, but there's a lot of things that go into physique contest performance, and getting ready for your next show could be actually impeding your overall long-term career in physique sport if you're competing back-to-back years at a time period where you need more off-season time spent to get bigger.
All right. Good stuff, my man. Now, it's 8:20 in the real-time zone here. So we need to go and do some rapid fire here and try to give the people what they want, address some of these questions in the chat. So we're going to go quick here. So let's see. We already answered this one basically from the Greek Trojan about, well.
About the dip bars one right above it.
Okay, easy, Helms. If I have a set of dip bars at home and my goal is to grow enormous tries, is there any reason not to do like 5 sets of dips every other day on top of my typical training program? And I've seen similar questions about like, hey, I want to have a huge back. I have a pull-up bar. Why not do a few sets, you know, maybe even daily? What do you think, Helms?
I think physics is the same inside gyms or in your home, and the appropriate amount of volume, intensity, rep ranges, and the way you should train a given muscle group applies holistically. So if you think your 5-day program is set up perfectly to blast your tries and make them get enormous, the reason would be now you're doing in excess of that at home with dips, and they also train your anterior delts, triceps. However, if you want to incorporate 5 sets of 15 dips every other day on top of what you do in your 5 lifting days, just make sure you account for it.
All right. Good stuff. Now, I misread this question previously when I was like skimming it. We got a question from the Greek Trojan about cutting, and they said hunger is actually not a big issue, but just feeling a lot of fatigue and lethargy while dieting. Any strategies other than caffeine to minimize this effect? Again, caffeine's tricky because you kind of saturate its utility without going to like really high doses. So caffeine, I still would use it in this scenario personally because I like having coffee in the morning, but I try not to get to the point where I'm abusing caffeine, especially later in the day or with tremendously high daily doses. I try to, most of the papers say try to keep it below like 400 to 600 milligrams per day if you can. Probably not a terrible heuristic to shoot for. Now, in terms of reducing fatigue and lethargy while dieting, I wish I had a really good solution. Personally, I would say sleep hygiene is king. That's kind of the best thing you can do, is try to get really high quality sleep. And the other thing I would mention is sometimes when you think you need caffeine as a nice pick-me-up, sometimes just going for a little walk, getting a little tiny bit of physical activity can actually kind of get a little bit more energy going in the acute sense. But unfortunately, that's kind of all I can really offer here. Helms, do you have any special tricks that I'm not aware of?
Big ones are make sure you're not losing too fast. Have a consistent eating schedule. And I think don't heavily bias any one meal with a ton of calories. And those are the main ones.
Yeah, good stuff. So spread that out throughout the day and you won't have the big peaks and valleys with energy level. All right. To build aerobic capacity and maximize general heart health, what type and quantity of cardio is best? Zone 1, zone 2, zone 3, a combination? I actually think that you can get the lion's share of the heart or cardiometabolic benefit of physical activity by really using whatever zone of cardio is preferable to you. I would say shooting for kind of the standard government guidelines, which is 150 minutes per week of lower intensity cardio or 75 minutes per week of, you know, higher intensity cardio or a combination of the two. Usually that's enough to kind of check the kind of basic boxes for being physically active enough to enjoy the vast majority of the health benefits. Now, in terms of building aerobic capacity, that's where you likely will need to, if you're trying to really dramatically improve your aerobic capacity, you probably will have to push to higher volumes, higher intensities. I think most folks who are really trying to maximize their VO2 max will incorporate a hefty dose of cardio above and beyond zone 2 into some of those higher intensities. But then, you know, you start getting into an area of kind of cardio program design for performance where I don't have a lot of expertise. And it really would kind of depend on the exact endeavor that you are involved with, right? So cardio, you know, it building aerobic capacity with cardio looks very different if you run the 800 meter or, you know, 400 meter or 1600 meter race, or if you're an ultra marathoner, or if you're a cross country skier. So to give anything more specific, I think I'd probably need a much more detailed look at what you're trying to really achieve with that program. What do you think, Helms?
Yeah, I think it's important just to distinguish between health and cardio and building aerobic capacity.
Yeah.
Then what you have to do to maximize health is like walk 8,000 steps per day or more. And then you get almost nothing beyond that. And then as far as building aerobic capacity, like you said, you need more specificity, but ultimately you can get it done in any zone. And the higher the heart rate zone, the less total volume you need to do because the intensity is higher. And it really just comes down to time, I would say. And I do think you can get it done in much lower heart rate zones if you're just willing to go for longer time periods.
Yeah. A user with a very complicated username informs me that bull sharks occasionally swim up freshwater channels. I think I'm about a 3-hour drive inland, so I think I'm still good in my lake locally, but it's still good to know. I appreciate the heads up there. Let's see, skimming through down here. This is an interesting one. Helms, I'm seeing one about isometrics. Are there studies that exist comparing the effect of adding isometric holds at the peak of a lift with controlled eccentric and concentric phases versus just performing the lift with standard continuous motion? So do we have any studies looking at isometric holds within the context of you know, completing repetitions like that?
Not that I'm aware of, and I would direct this person to a review of isometric training by Aranchuk and colleagues that came out in the last couple of years, and they have a pretty good description of all the various types of isometrics and how they have been used or could be used and difference in like yielding isometrics versus isometrics against a movable object, etc. It's a good read if you're interested in doing a deep dive on this, but yeah, a lot of the ways that isometrics are used in practice have not yet been studied, unfortunately.
Yeah. So let's see, we've got one from Richard here. Do you see transition of muscle type 2 to hybrid, type 2 or hybrid to some less optimal muscle type for power during a cut? So when you're cutting, are we getting a transition of fiber types from faster to slower? And how can you minimize losing, or how can you minimize this potential transition if it occurs? Do you know if there's a fiber type transition associated with cutting?
I'm not aware of preferential losses of specific fiber types during cutting, but I don't think that's an unreasonable hypothesis that could occur.
Right.
And I actually am now curious. I would have to dig around, but I have not seen anything about caloric deficit-induced preferential loss of muscle mass.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that sarcopenia is characterized more often by the loss of type 2 fibers. And a lot of sarcopenia is sometimes, I will say, muscle loss due to aging, independent of physical activity, is absolutely a thing. There is a certain point where age will impact that. But a lot of sarcopenia is concurrently occurring with people getting more and more sedentary with time.
Yeah.
So I think it's certainly possible that if you are losing muscle mass due to inactivity, that you would preferentially lose type 2 fibers. But I think that's probably not going to be happening in the context that this person's asking the question, where they're performing resistance training still and probably doing more activity than normal as a cardio adjunct. So
yeah,
I don't know how useful that is, but thinking about that.
Yeah, you know, another interesting thing is that in some of the papers by Rosenbaum and Liebel, when they were looking at the efficiency of physical activity, can you still hear me, Holmes?
Yes.
Okay, It looks like there are some technical difficulties. But anyway, when we look at those studies where they're looking at the efficiency of low-intensity physical activity, what was really fascinating was that there was actually a shift in substrate utilization. And they were speculating, based on the kind of broad outcome of differences in substrate utilization, they think that there was kind of a preferential shift toward more aerobic metabolism in the muscle and greater utilization of those type 1 fibers rather than type 2 fibers that tend to be more fatigable and glycolytic. So I don't think they got sensitive enough like biopsy data of the muscles to look at whether or not you would say that they have really shifted from one kind of muscle fiber phenotype to the other. You know, cause sometimes those shifts aren't as straightforward and cut and dry as you might think. Sometimes it's more of a shift in terms of functionality and some of the metabolic characteristics. But either way, like you said, I do think that there's probably some validity to this hypothesis. I'm not familiar with a ton of data on it, but the important thing is, in my opinion, I generally don't tell anyone to train in a manner that aims to intentionally alter fiber type. Usually I tell people train for what your sport or activity requires. If any fiber type of shifts, any fiber shifts occur because of that, that's the cost of doing business. But usually what we see with just about any type of training is that a lot of our 2X fibers shift to something that's more fatigue resistant. So we go from 2X to usually 2A or some of the intermediate fiber types between them and all that stuff. But I usually tell people not to even try to train with the intention of inducing or mitigating a fiber type shift. That stuff happens usually for good reason, and there's not a ton that we can really do about it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's well said. It's one of the things where you're focusing on the mechanism of the adaptation probably too much rather than the adaptation itself, and how your body gets there is to some degree up to itself, and sometimes they overestimate which aspects of the adaptation are contributing to it.
Yeah.
And in a practical sense, yeah, you do explosive work, you're going to be more explosive for sure.
Yeah. And if you really want a lot of type 2X fibers, my recommendation would be stop training, go to space, and stay there for about a year. That's the best way to do it. Sorry to cut you off with that somewhat facetious but also true statement.
All good. No, Eli asked a follow-up question. I just noticed they're asking what the PubMed ID for the isometric training review that I suggested they look at. I'm not sure if this is the best way to do it as me just saying it out loud, but it is 305-804-6868. That's 305-804-6868. I feel like this is a telethon now.
But I was thinking,
showing by age.
I was thinking it kind of feels like we're reading out the lottery numbers for the night. You know, the little ping pong balls are coming in.
It's titled, this might be easier, Isometric Training and Long-Term Adaptations, Effects of Muscle Length, Intensity, and Intent, a Systematic Review. It was published 2019. Lead author is Oranchuk, O-R-A-N-C-H-U-K. It's a good one to read.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So we probably need to wrap up here. I don't know if we're going to get to every single question and comment, but I think we have gotten the lion's share tonight. One question that jumped out to me, and while I'm answering this, if you want to look for any others that you really want to hit before we go, one that jumped out to me was, what are our thoughts on nicotine as an appetite suppressant? Not like smoking cigarettes, but maybe gum or Zyn. I've heard of Zyn. I'm going to show how out of touch I am. I don't know what it is. As far as I can tell, it looks like some kind of like maybe a pouch that you use almost like a dip, but maybe there's no tobacco in it. It's just pure nicotine, and you don't have to have like, because dip back in the day, they would sell the little pouches of dip, but you still would have that thing where there's like the little tiny sharp things that irritate the gum and the nicotine goes in. I don't know the difference between Zyn and that, if I even have any idea what Zyn is. But anyway, the question's about nicotine, and let's assume that we're talking about nicotine in the absence of tobacco-related carcinogens, right? So could be a nicotine patch, nicotine gum, whatever. Without question, you know, my wife studied tobacco cessation, so she's the expert here on this particular topic. But without question, if you are shifting from being a tobacco user to someone who is using a non-tobacco form of nicotine, particularly if it's en route to quit altogether, that's obviously a tremendously beneficial change to make. If you were going to use a type of nicotine, it certainly, you know, in terms of health outcomes, certainly shouldn't be something tobacco-based. Even vaping, I'm a little bit skeptical of, in the sense that vaporized products in our lungs really like air, and they don't really like a lot else. That's my expert high-level take on lung physiology. I'm a little bit skeptical about... Now, I still think it'd be a heck of a lot better than a cigarette if I had to guess, but I'm not an expert in this area, so no one should be making any decisions based on my on-the-fly speculations here. But the folks I've talked to have said probably better to vape than to smoke cigarettes, but probably better to do a different nicotine alternative that doesn't involve vaporized or combusted products in your lungs. Even still, though, I am not a huge advocate of nicotine, even in the form of like a gum or a patch, where you're not getting any carcinogens, there's no combustion or vaporization products in the lungs. I'm still not an advocate for it for a couple reasons. First of all, nicotine doesn't seem to be super terrible, but there are some studies linking it to somewhat unfavorable effects on the cardiovascular system, things like high blood pressure and things like that. On top of that, being addicted to something is generally not a fun way to live, you know, because usually when you don't have it, you actually feel kind of crummy. And I would never voluntarily enter that type of situation. Like nicotine withdrawal is an uncomfortable thing that detracts from quality of life. And so I would not voluntarily use an addictive substance for appetite suppression, knowing that there's, you know, physiological withdrawal symptoms that come with it. Seems like not a great plan to me personally, based on how I like to live my life. The other thing that I will mention that's kind of talked about far less is, let's say that you want to start using nicotine for appetite suppression and you do develop a physical or physiological dependence upon it, I actually think that that could be negative for your sleep quality. And there is research to support that. The challenge with nicotine is, if you have it really close to bedtime, it will impair sleep. You know, it does have stimulatory effects. Now, the half-life isn't nearly as long as coffee or caffeine, right? So it's not like you have to stop having all of your nicotine after noon in order to avoid sleep impacts. But there's still a window of time that's measured in hours, not minutes, where, you know, nicotine very close before bed, you know, within an hour or two, has been shown to interrupt sleep quality. And you say, okay, well, then cool, then I'll move it to a different time of day. Helms, can you still hear me? I'm hearing weird sounds out here. Okay. So you'd say, okay, cool, then I'll just, you know, have it an hour or two before bed and I'll sleep like a baby. Well, the other issue is, you will actually have, there's evidence to suggest that nicotine withdrawal can actually impair your sleep quality, and that the onset of that, I believe if memory serves correctly, is as short as perhaps 4 hours after the most recent use. So you end up in a situation where the timing becomes very improbable, if not impossible, to have this perfectly timed nicotine use that is far enough from bedtime that it's not going to impair sleep on the front end, but also close enough to bedtime that you're not going to potentially disrupt sleep quality like midway through the night, you know, 4, 5, maybe 6 hours after the last use of nicotine. So for all those reasons, I generally encourage people not to use nicotine while still having the caveat that if using a non-tobacco alternative is something that reduces your use of tobacco products, then definitely that is a positive thing. Helms, I'm going to assume you have no opinions whatsoever about nicotine. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm not well read enough on it, to be honest.
All right. So are there any other questions you want to hit before we go? Basically, balls in your court, and then we'll wrap up for the night.
You know, I think we got to them all. There's not a tremendous amount of additional questions that I saw. I think we covered most of them. There was one that we absolutely can't do in a short space of thoughts on reducing volume during a cut. So we'll have to save that for next time. Although we do have an iron culture episode where I talk about that a good bit if you want to guys go dig in the crates. Appreciate everybody tuning in.
Absolutely, folks. We appreciate it. Love having folks in the live chat from all over the world. Love getting the hashtags coming in. Thanks so much for participating. If you've never participated, I do encourage you to drop in on a Wednesday night. But as I said previously, this upcoming Wednesday night, we will not be live. That'll be Wednesday the 22nd. I will be flying back from what I hope to be a good presentation at the Collegiate and Professional Sports Dietitians Association annual meeting in Kansas City. Kansas City, of course, a big barbecue destination. Not super appetizing for a vegetarian like myself, but nonetheless looking forward to seeing a bunch of really fantastic sport nutritionists who work with some of the best athletes in the world. It should be a lot of fun. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Thanks as always for supporting the Mass Research Review and all of the different endeavors that make up the Mass Extended Universe. We will be back in 1 week with a pre-recorded video and then the week after that with another live episode. Everyone take care of yourself and we will be back soon.